from Scotland Yard. Two stories from the files of the London police. Here is your narrator, Clive Brooks.
How do you do? This is Clive Brooks. The secret of Scotland Yard that I'm going to tell you today is a closely guarded one. I'd rather you didn't spread it around if you don't mind. It seems that towards the end of the last century, the Yard had on its payroll an inspector called Duskovich, whose devotion to his bank account exceeded his devotion to duty. Let's talk about a thing. Let me put to you a problem. How does a parish waiter rise to the title of count? The rank of a barrister at law and the possession of £30,000. All this was done by the man whose casebook history I'm going to tell you today. His name was Ori Farrell, a waiter with ambition. Not the usual waiter's ambition, the setting up of his own cafe. As he served the customers, Ori's dreams soared far beyond the kitchens and the neat rows of tables. Nature had bestowed on him certain gifts. He was handsome, ingratiating, shrewd. He had a command of languages and, a wonderful way with women. He used his talents to the full, and he had luck on his side as well. For instance, he was questioned by Inspector Drastovich. Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be talking about him. To achieve his ambitions, Ori used two methods, both requiring considerable courage. Our story opens in the summer of 1867 in that most glamorous of European capitals, Paris. At a corner table in one of the boulevard cafes, there sits an Englishman with a purpose. His name is William Cupp, and his purpose. Ah, we are just about to discover.
Oh, garçon! Garçon! Come in, monsieur!
At your service, sir.
Garçon, est-ce que vous pouvez...
Monsieur, would prefer to speak his native tongue?
Oh, you speak English, eh?
Yes.
Well, then perhaps you're the chap I'm looking for. Name of Henry, by any chance?
This is right, sir. Henri Perrault, at your service.
Good. I've been told you're the chap who can help me. Not without recompense, of course. You'll not find me stingy, you know. I'm here in Paris for a week. It's my first visit.
Yes. You wish to be shown the sights?
Exactly.
Now, Henry, I've been told that you know Paris backwards, and... that's how I want to see it.
But I've been up quite there.
Oh, too subtle for you, I expect. No, what I mean to say, none of this Eiffel Tower museum stuff for me. I want to see the places one hears about, the corners of the city hidden from the general run of the tourists.
I think I understand, monsieur. You wish to see why he called Paris the city of pleasure, eh?
Every kind of pleasure, eh, monsieur?
Oh,
The pleasure-seeking Mr. Cotton was well satisfied with his guide, who seemed to have an inexhaustible knowledge of the shadier parts of the capital. For his part, Ori was delighted with his employer, whom he found to be a wealthy bachelor with no inhibitions about tipping. Imagine his further delight when, after a few days, the globe-trotting Englishman offered him a more permanent and rewarding form of employment, that of traveling companion and courier. Ori accepted with alacrity, and within a few days, the couple arrived at their first port of call, Constantinople.
Quite up to date, Henry. I expected the place to be centuries out of date, but it is. No, indeed, monsieur, very pleasant. I hope you find my services to your satisfaction, monsieur, on these voyages.
Oh, absolutely. I see no reason why the arrangement shouldn't work out perfectly. Now, where are my gloves?
You are going out, monsieur, aren't you, eh?
Well, no point in wasting time, Henry. And you're coming with me. I hope to nose out the spots of interest.
Very well, monsieur. We are staying for some time here in Constantinople.
Well, more than a night, anyway.
I think I'd better carry all my money with me. You never know with these foreigners.
Very wise, monsieur, very wise. One should not leave anything valuable in strange hotels. Very wise to keep it with you at all times.
It was in Constantinople that the tour came to an abrupt end. Mr. William Cotton was never seen again in Constantinople or anywhere else. Ori Perrault disappeared at the same time, but a certain Count Ori de Tourville, who turned up in Scarborough, England, later that year, bore a resemblance, quite a remarkable resemblance, to the late Mr. Cotton's traveling companion. True, Ori the Count was impeccably dressed. He carried himself with an air, and he was wealthy, as Ori the waiter had never been until Mr. Cotton disappeared. The high society of Scarborough, that most fashionable 19th century resort, was soon agog over the Count's lavish ways.
My dear, I'm completely enchanted with the natural ball. Why, it's such a good season. So sweet of you to say so, Eileen. I must say it's turning out to be most successful. Every trifling maiden must be here tonight. And a pleasing aboard as well. By the way, have you got that charming contretemps here? My dear, I've been longing for an introduction all evening. The things I've heard of him, they say he has the house in every country of Europe. All the important ones, anyway.
I was so pleased if he managed to come tonight. He's so clever, aren't
you? Naturally. Half the mothers in Scarborough are praying for him to look in the direction of their daughter. Oh, look! He's coming this way. Oh, doesn't he look magnificent? Oh, you'd be a darling to introduce.
But of course. Come.
I must say, he's a fine figure of a man.
Oh, divine.
Such an air. Oh, and that beard.
At your service, madame.
Oh, I mean, may I introduce Monsieur le Comte de Turgis?
Oh, how do you do?
Great honor, you say.
I've been anxious to meet you, Count. I'm hoping you'll be able to attend a little soiree I'm giving on Tuesday.
Tuesday? Ah, your grace, I am so sorry. I have already accepted an invitation for that day.
Oh, what a pity. Oh, but I know you're in great demand.
Everyone has been most kind. And now, if you excuse me, I hear them play the waltz, and I am engaged for this.
Not that fascinating, yet a rhythm, Count.
It is rather, I am to dance, madame. Excuse me.
Using every trick known to him, as a waiter, a man, and a Frenchman at that, Henri was now bent on the conquest of Miss Henrietta Brigham, a young lady who was due to inherit £30,000 on the death of her widowed mother. And that was when pounds were pounds. Whether or not the Count was influenced by that fact, he certainly made a dashing wooer and a successful one.
My darling little wife, you have made me so happy.
Oh, wasn't it a wonderful wedding, Henry? Wasn't it grand?
Everyone was most kind.
And now our honeymoon. Paris.
About that, Henrietta, is this difficulty has arisen in the matter of transferring my money. I was wondering, do you think your mother might be willing to make me a loan?
But I'm sure she'd be delighted to, my love.
Good. I'll ask her right away. Just a little trouble, you understand, over the transfers.
The truth, of course, was that the Count, having used up all William Cotton's money in making a big splash at Scarborough, was now fat broke. Still, Mama Brigham was only too pleased to make her son-in-law alone. Once. But when Henri, having spent the whole sum on the honeymoon, returned with a request for more, he soon became aware of the trickiness of his position. His wife had no means of her own, and all requests had to be made to Mrs. Brigham, who not only feigned deafness on such occasions, but after a few months, horror of horrors, began hinting that repayment of the first loan would be welcome. Drastic action was obviously necessary, and in taking it, Henri the waiter was to show that no one is more ruthless than a man trying to maintain a standard of living to which he is not accustomed.
Where are you off to, Henri, dear?
It is today I pay your mother a visit, my darling, and pay her back the money. There are two things, eh?
What money? Oh, did you lend it for the honeymoon?
Yes. I had a letter yesterday asking me to lunch.
Yes, you? Why, that's unlike Mama.
I must go now, Henrietta.
Give her my love, Henry. Sarah, I'll be calling on her tomorrow, and I'll be bringing baby to see her.
Yes, my dear. I will tell her.
But, Monsieur Lecomte, it is most extraordinary. Mrs. Brigham's health has been excellent. That's very remarkable.
But you understand, Doctor. Mrs. Brigham, she said to me in her letter, bring me a pistol, I have a fear of burglars. Well, I bring a gun with me, this gun that you see in her hand. She handled it, examined it, and suddenly it go off. And when I kneel by her side, the Lord, she is dead. A terrible accident, Doctor, a terrible accident. My poor wife, she is just at the bed, you know. She will be so shocked to hear of this so terrible accident.
Not only terrible, but curious. Seeing that the bullet wound was in the back of Mrs. Brigham's head. But then, we have a nobleman's word for it, and the doctor has a nobleman's set for it. So the certificate was signed without delay. But after the purely formal request, Scotland Yard, interested by several suspicious letters from relatives of Mrs. Brigham, sent one Inspector Gluskovich to make some inquiries.
As these doubts have been raised, Count, I've been sent, as it were, to Well, I can't say I like prying, sir, especially with a gentleman like you.
Tell me, Inspector, Doskovic is surely not an Englishman.
Well, now you come to mention it, sir, it isn't. I've got Russian blood in me, as a matter of fact.
Interesting. My mother, she was Russian.
Departed, sir?
Yes, Inspector, just like Mrs. Brigham.
I'm very sorry to hear it, Count. Very sorry.
Inspector Doskovic, I am certain your commissioner of police does not pay you sufficient money in your job. I would like to help you if possible.
Please keep your voice down, Count.
Oh, so sorry. I think we can come to an arrangement, you and I. So I shall be saved having to answer questions about my mother-in-law. And you, Inspector, will be spared having to ask them. Now then, where is my ticket?
After a suitable interval, Inspector Daskovic reported to headquarters that there was no case. And the commissioner of police dropped the matter. Oh, by the way, Daskovic wasn't long in the force. But I still prefer you not to talk about it. Back in Scarborough, however, Ollie was still trying to get his mother-in-law's 30,000. His countess had inherited it, all right, but was showing no desire to share it with him. Many a time Ollie pressed her to put some of the money at least into his account, only to be given an occasional £5 note for pocket money. Remembering Mr. William Cotton and Mrs. Brigham, we need not be surprised that Henrietta, Countess de Turville, soon became seriously ill and died, attended by the same doctor as had written the convenient death certificate for her mother. But the Count, who was bearing his grief with commendable fortitude, was destined to receive a far greater shock than the death of his wife.
My congratulations, Count. Thank you. You are my wife's lawyer.
I had that privilege. I cannot tell you, Count, two such losses in such a short space of time. You have my deepest...
You have the will that my wife left?
I have indeed.
Still,
how goes the phrase? In the midst of life?
Are there papers for me to sign before the money comes to me?
To your son, you mean, little Charles, sweet child.
To my son? What is this?
Your wife left the bulk of her fortune to your child, although you have a fairly large legacy. And, of course, the money would come to you in the event of your son's death. I think, Charles, where do you want to? But I said the wrong thing.
I say, Charles, these papers.
Well, yes.
The Parisian waiter was by no means content with the legacy. He meant to have the whole 30,000. Two lives that had stood in his way had been snuffed out. Would there soon be another death in the Tourville family?
Well, when I get through high school, I might try to get a job that pays 50 or 60 a week so I can get some meals of my own. And then again, I might try to get into some college somewhere. Well, I might just sort of hang around and see what happens.
Some people, when they approach the end of their high school days, just don't know what to do next. And with all the possibilities open to young people nowadays, it's easy to understand why. But here's some good advice. If you'll be finishing high school soon, don't spend the next few years just marking time. Put them to good use, preparing for the future. One excellent way to do this is by joining the United States Air Force, America's aerospace team. As an airman, you'll learn a vital aerospace skill as you start a career in one of the world's most future-oriented organizations. Ask any Air Force recruiter for the facts about the aerospace team. You can be part of it.
Ori, Comte de Tourville, refused to be downhearted. He bore without a murmur the deaths of his mother-in-law and his wife. And when he realized that these deaths had risen upon and not to himself, Ori never gave way to despair. If at first you don't succeed, try again. So Ori tried his hand at arson.
I say, excuse me. It's Count Tourville, isn't it?
I am the Count, yes.
Well, I'm from the Daily Chronicle. This was your house, isn't it? Wasn't it, Count?
That is right. It's terrible tragedy.
Well, you seem very calm about it, Count. Is it insured?
Heavily insured, yes.
Ah. Well, was there anyone inside when it caught fire?
Myself and my small son, Charles. Unfortunately, there is no way out for him.
What? Did you mean he's trapped in there?
But he's hard.
No?
There is no need. We cannot get him out. He is locked in.
But have they tried, sir? Has everything possible been done? Oh, look, there's a body over there. I'll see if we can...
There is nothing he can do.
Don't give up, old dear. Those men can do wonders.
Perhaps. But we cannot save my son.
No! The father's going to...
interfering fool.
There, I told you he wouldn't give up without trying.
He's going out the back way. Slimy, what's that?
They're putting the ladder over the side window.
They can't get my son out. They can't, I tell you. He's locked in his room. There is no way out for him.
Don't take on so dearly. Don't take him this way, sir.
Oh, mon Dieu, qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire?
Oh, he's there. He's the side window. He's coming down the ladder. I can't see him. He's got to see.
Just, he's got the kid in his arms. He saved him.
Wonderful thing, Bobby, don't you think so,
Captain? Imbécile, espèce de crétin! Idiot!
It was vexing to the Count. All that trouble over laying the fire completely wasted by an interfering policeman. The handsome ex-waiter was to be foiled again. The insurance company, instead of politely handing over the money, started asking questions. Awkward questions. Devilish awkward. Count Henri de Tourville found himself pumped for plausible answers. The company then had the gall to say that if he wanted to get any cash out of them, he'd better bring an action. Now, that was the last thing that Henri wanted. So he found a willing relative to adopt his son, and he left Scarborough, dropping his title as he went, and made his way to London.
London, August 5th, 1871. The Home Office has granted the request of Mr. Henri de Tourville for British citizenship. Monsieur de Tourville wishes it to be known that he is anglicizing his name to Henry de Tourville. London Chit Chat, June 8, 1872. Among those answering the call to the bar in the Middle Temple today was that well-known figure in London society, Henry de Tourville. Mr. de Tourville explained to our representative that he had no intention of practicing. It is merely, he recorded, that I think it good to have barrister at law after my name. Incidentally, it is whispered that Mr. de Tourville is thinking of giving his name to another. We hope to be the first to announce the engagement.
But the whispers were unfounded. While he could afford to remain a bachelor, Henri de Tourville merely flirted with the many women who found him so attractive. But by 1875, his bank account was looking rather seedy. And Henri realized it was time to stop trifling and get down to business. So a Mrs. Madeline Miller, a childless widow, age 45, income £7,000 a year, was asked, to her delight, to become Mrs. de Tourville.
Really, Madeleine, must we always have this Sarah, your maid, with us, even on our honeymoon?
You've been with me so long, Henry, I'd feel so lost without her.
But, my dear, a man when he marries wishes to be alone with his wife. I never feel, as you say, at home when she is always at our side.
Darling, here comes the proprietor.
Madame de Tourville, and Mr. also. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
You are enjoying yourself here, sir? This beautiful country. Just right for the honeymoon, no?
Yes, indeed, yes.
You have, of course, visited Ferdinand Hirst?
I have, a long time ago. I am taking my wife tomorrow.
Oh, yes, yes, tomorrow. It will be a fine day for you.
I do so want to see the festivities. I hear it's so exciting and of you.
Oh, you shall be thrilled by the Ferdinand Hirst, madame.
Looking forward to it enormously.
Honeymoon couples like it always. It is very quiet up there on the cliff. People can be alone, yes?
Yes, yes, I have been there once, I told you.
of course. Now, if you would be so kind, excuse, I make arrangements for the picnic luncheon for you to take with you in the carriage.
And I'll stay and find Sarah and tell her about tomorrow.
Oh, Madeleine, I must tell you that the carriage tomorrow will only be big enough for you and me.
Nonsense, Henry. Surely you can get a bigger one. Sarah would so like the excursion.
But why, my darling, it will be so much nicer just you and me alone. You and I, no one else, Madeleine. You are all I want. Just you and me, Madeleine.
Dear love, when you say it like that, what can I answer but yes?
The next morning, Henri and Madeleine set off to view the famous beauty spot. As they approached the pass, the servant stopped the carriage and informed the coachman that he and his wife would finish the journey on foot. Nothing strange about that. It was a lovely day, and after giving them instructions, the coachman left and drove back alone. The morning passed in the afternoon, and as the evening came to night, the proprietor of the hotel and his wife became more and more anxious.
But the English milord knows that we are supper at 8. Now, it is already after 9. they should have been here long ago.
A search party should be sent to look for them.
We give them another 5 minutes. Then...
You must go quickly. My wife, my Madeleine, terrible accident. She was walking too near the edge. I told her not to go there, but she would not listen, and then, it is too terrible. We must go quickly. I know exactly where it was that she fell. Alors, I tell you, I am certain it was here.
Oh, they'll do not be anxious, sir.
Oh,
he is down there, the men will find her.
Here they come now. Excuse me.
Excuse me, Mr. De Tourville. The men have found the body of your wife.
Dead?
Yes, dead.
I want you to fetch up the corpse and bring it back to the hotel.
Yes.
No, of course.
What? That cannot be.
Who is this man?
This is Sergeant Magnus Fritz, sir, of the local police.
The body must stay where she is.
But why is that? Why must it stay there? Nonsense!
One of my men will watch it and stay there until the affair has been investigated. Herr de Tourville, the corpse of your wife certainly not without assistance to this place came when we found it. And there are other signs. I must report this affair to my superiors. An inquiry there must be.
Funding of this court of inquiry is that the sick lady died through an accident, and no responsibility whatever for it attached to this worthy gentleman, a visitor to our country from England, who has this court's deep sympathy in his sad bereavement. I instruct that he leave this court a free man, that his passport be returned to him without delay.
So, for the third time, Ori went to collect the dividends from debts. Back in London, the executor of Madeline's will, having heard his sad tale, paid without hesitation to Tourville the sum of nearly £40,000. Ori's biggest jackpot yet. This most successful trickster settled down once more to his life of ease. But one evening, several months after his return to England, he was interrupted as he was dressing for dinner.
And it is really most inconvenient for me to receive a visitor at this time, my dear sir. I am sorry to be inhospitable, but, sir...
I'm afraid you'll have to receive me, Mr. de Tourville. I'm Inspector Clark, and I've come from Scotland Yard. I want you to come with me now to Bow Street.
Bow Street? Scotland Yard? Inspector? What is this? Some matter of police? I am sorry, I'm just going out to dinner.
You never have to wait, sir. Some few days, perhaps. I hold a warrant for your arrest. The charge is... that you murdered your wife in the Austrian Tyrol on the 16th of July, 1876.
But this is imbecilic nonsense. In any case, I was abandoned.
Abandoned, sir?
Liberated. Delivered. Surrender, as you say. Set free. Free from all responsibility.
That was in Austria, Mr. de Tourville. If the Bow Street magistrate wants to see you now, you'll be charged formally, and counsel will be appointed for your defense.
How do you do, Mr. de Tourville? My name is Williams, Montague Williams, QC, at your service. I will defend you.
But I have already been defended. In Austria, I am free.
Oh, don't you know then? The case is reopened. Some of your late wife's... my condolences, by the way, sir. Your wife's relative sent a detective over to Austria recently. This detective looked into the facts of your wife's death and seems to think that she may have been pushed. So the Austrian government wants you back to try you again.
But I am an Englishman.
Yes, sir. And that is the reason why they're to try you to see whether there is any prima facie case against you, enough to justify extradition.
And if I am sent to Austria and they try me again and they find me guilty, how will the Austrians punish me?
They'll hang you, sir. They'll hang you.
Montague Williams, QC, perhaps because he wasn't a woman, was not completely covered by Henri. In fact, during the London trial, he wrote a description of his client in a letter to a friend.
The accused hair, moustache, and other hirsute appendages are of a glossy blackness that is suggestive of a meretricious application. His manner in court is jaunty, and he waved his ringed hand to his friends in a fashion which I considered unbecoming. His shirt front literally twisted. I feel instinctively that there is something of a cad about him. In spite of this, I naturally should defend him to the best of my ability,
But the evidence is
KGO San Diego.
The prisoner was missing. His clothes were torn, his face and arms were bruised. But he said he had immediately come to the hotel after the accident. This woman was lying on the ground at the top of the precipice, not near the body. She had not been stopped by the rocks while falling, very strange. In the dirt near the corpse, marks were found showing that it had along the ground been dragged after falling.
And in view of all these circumstances, I find there is a prima facie case against the prisoner. In accordance, therefore, with the Treaty of Extradition with Austria, he must hereupon be surrendered to the Austrian.
Scotland Yard sent Inspector Clark to honor his last trial in Vienna. He took with him the skull of Mrs. Brigham and the evidence gathered by the insurance company concerning the fire in Scarborough. Hundreds of depositions were read, dozens of witnesses heard. Henri himself made a speech at the end of which the judge told him he talked too much. Finally, Henri Perrault, alias Henri de Tourville, was sentenced to death. But Lady Luck gave him a last gift, and the sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. Plenty of time for Henri to reflect that although serving drinks in a Paris cafe has some drawbacks, serving sentences in a Vienna prison has no advantages. And by the way, do keep quiet about Inspector Druskovich. That's one of the secrets Scotland Yard really likes to keep. Well, that's all for now, but I'll be back again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Meanwhile, this is Clive Brook saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.